We have seven lawyers, and we have a 70-minute panel. They're all going to pretend they're at the appellate court, so they're going to do a good countdown, but you do not want to miss this. The Second Amendment Foundation was founded in 1974. Its core mission was education and legal defense. In 1984, we did not have all of the options that we have now for legal defense. But this has become an integral part of the Second Amendment Foundation. As other people mentioned, there was Heller, there was McDonald, there was Ezell. We have done a lot of the alienage laws. We have done the public housing. We have done the range cases. We continue on with many, many other cases. We have been successful with a couple of his applied challenges for misdemeanor prohibitions. These seven attorneys represent the Second Amendment Foundation in many cases. Because there are seven, we have 70 minutes, I'm going to treat this like an appellate argument. So if they go over their 10-minute allotment, I've been trying to stay out of the picture, I'll come behind them and I will poke them with this pen. I may or may not keep the cap on this permanent marker, depending on how many times I have to poke them. So we will start in alphabetical order, so I would like to invite John Dillon to come to the mic, and I'd like him to introduce himself and his firm. Thank you.
I'm hoping this doesn't count against my time, but I'm now scared to be standing next to her right now. All right. So good afternoon. My name is John Dillon. I am truly honored to be speaking before you today, to be speaking amongst the leaders of Second Amendment policy, activism, and the general firearms community, many of which I'm a personal fan of. It's a humbling experience. So as an associate attorney at my firm, Gatzke, Dillon & Balance, I run the firearms practice in which I do everything I can to assist federally licensed dealers and individuals to navigate the legal minefield that is gun ownership in California. As they say, we are behind enemy lines. In California, we have it all. It's a gun control supporter's dream. We have the assault weapon ban. We have a 10-day waiting period. We have an approved list of handguns that can be sold in the state. We have micro-stamping requirements on handguns, a theoretical firearms tracing technology that's never been proven to actually exist. We have high-capacity magazine bans, universal background checks, and gun violence restraining orders, or red flag laws. List goes on and on. However, none of these laws actually reduce gun violence, mass shooting, suicides, or general criminal behavior. Criminals still get their guns illegally, and regardless of what law California puts in place. In California, the law-abiding gun owner is the one that's negatively affected by these laws. And unfortunately, California is the birthplace for many of these draconian and absurd laws that are now being proposed on the federal level and in your individual states. This is why it's vitally important to not write California off as a lost cause. This is the reason I believe the fight for the Second Amendment depends on our success in California and why we fight so hard to oppose these laws in California. Most recently, I've had the pleasure of stepping into the ring and challenging two of California's feel-good gun restrictions, representing California individuals and FFLs, as well as Second Amendment Foundation, Firearms Policy Coalition, Firearms Policy Foundation, the Cal Gun Rights Foundation, and the San Diego County Gun Owners Association. As these are active cases, I can't go into too much detail, but I will give you a nice little summary. So as of July 1st, 2019, California enacted a ban on the selling and transferring of all types of firearms to young adults ages 18 to 20. According to the state, these young adults who can enter into the military and die for their country, enter into contracts, get married, and be tried as adults in criminal matters, they are too immature and impulsive to be trusted with guns. So the state decided to completely strip them of their fundamental right of self-defense. Our federal court case, Jones v. Becerra, is going to change that. Our Constitution is very clear. A review of firearms restrictions dating back to colonial and founding eras are clear. Young adults have the right to defend themselves. They have the right to keep and bear arms, and we're going to prove that in court. I've also had the pleasure of challenging California's assault weapon ban in another federal court challenge, Miller v. Becerra. In this case, I'm working with another fantastic attorney who you're going to hear from today, George Lee. And whether you're up to date on California's many gun restrictions, you're now becoming familiar with the assault weapon laws because the federal assault weapon ban that was currently that's been proposed was based off of California's law. In California, among the other restrictions of what kind of plastic grip or adjustable stock you can attach onto your gun, if an individual takes their lawfully owned rifle that does not meet the definition of an assault weapon, and they insert their lawfully owned high-capacity magazine into that gun, they've now magically created an assault weapon and have committed at least two felonies under California law. Can't have that. Both of these guns and their magazines are arguably the most commonly used firearms in the country and are used for self-defense, sport, recreation, hunting, and any other lawful purpose you can think of. The Supreme Court in Heller was clear. These arms are fully protected under the Second Amendment, and we're going to hold the state of California to that. The Second Amendment litigation efforts are stronger than ever. We are going to do everything we can to restore the Second Amendment to California. Nevertheless, past legal decisions in California, as well as decisions that come out of the Ninth Circuit, have showed us that even when the Constitution and the law is on our side, it is always an uphill battle. Therefore, that's why it's extremely important that all of you continue to do what you do. Continue to be responsible advocates for the Second Amendment. Help replace ignorance with knowledge, introduce reason and spread awareness, and never be complacent because the state that you are in doesn't have those crazy laws like that one on the coast. We have the numbers and support to put the right people into office that defend the Constitution rather than strip it of its meaning. Litigation is truly the last stand when it comes to these laws. We cannot forget the many tools that we have available to us through these organizations, our grassroots efforts, and through our vote. I'm a gun owner in California. I'm fighting for my rights as well as your rights. It's personal. It really is. We're going to do everything we can to restore those rights. Thank you.
If I could ask the gentleman in the back to stop talking, thank you so much. Now, I'd like to welcome Matthew Goldstein. Thank you.
When I was a police officer, we had this saying. It was front sight, trigger pull. That doesn't have anything to do with what I'm about to talk about, but I was told that I had 8 minutes, and I just heard I had 10 minutes, so I got 2 minutes to play with. So my name is Matthew Goldstein. I am the chair of the International Trade and National Security Group over at law firm of Faring and Medcoff in Arizona. I'm an ITAR guy, and I'm here to talk about the case of Defense Distributed and the Second Amendment Foundation and Con Williamson versus the United States Department of State, and to talk about the impact of the Department of State's application of the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, the ITAR, on gun-related speech that's protected under the First and Second Amendment. Now, the Department of State implements the ITAR to protect United States national security and foreign policy interests. And the ITAR, as many of you may know, prohibit or restrict the exports of defense articles from the United States. And a defense article is that's items, software, technical data that's described on the ITAR United States Munitions List, the USML. And the USML has 21 categories of defense articles that are subject to control. The very first, Category 1 of the USML, is for firearms. And the Department of State knows, or it should know, that it cannot impose the ITAR as a prior restraint on public speech. Since 1978, The United States Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel has advised the Department of State, the Department of Commerce, the White House, and even Congress that to impose a prior restraint under the ITAR or other export regulations on public speech violates the First Amendment. In 1997, in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, the Department of Justice issued a report to Congress about a proposal to impose a strict liability prohibition on the publication of bomb-making information on the Internet. And the Department of Justice said, you can't do that. It would violate the First Amendment. So what changed? Well, in December 2012, a company out of Texas named Defense Distributed posted a variety of gun-related information on the Internet. This information included CAD, computer-assisted design files, that can be used with a 3D printer to manufacture a high-capacity magazine, an AR-15 lower receiver, and a one-shot gun called the Liberator. What also happened in December 2012? There was the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. There was a tragic shooting in which a shooter shot and killed 26 people, 20 of which were children. In response, the Obama administration set forth an announcement of a very ambitious gun control agenda. A primary focus of this agenda was a ban on high-capacity magazines. Now, it's, as you can imagine, difficult to control high-capacity magazines when folks can just print them in the privacy of their home. And so it's within this background that in May 2013, the Department of State sent Defense Distributed a letter warning that it might have violated the ITAR because it did not obtain prior approval from the Department of State before publishing the information on the Internet. It warned, it demanded that the company take down the information it posted online, and it instructed Defense Distributed to file what they call commodity jurisdiction requests with the Department of State, basically requested the agency to determine whether or not the files themselves are indeed subject to ITAR control. Defense Distributed complied with every one of these requests. It took down the information, and it submitted the commodity jurisdiction requests, actually 10 requests. After 2 years of waiting, there was no response. And so, Defense Distributed, the Second Amendment Foundation, filed a lawsuit in the Federal District Court for the Western District of Texas against the Department of State, the Director of Defense Trade Controls, which is the subordinate agency in the Department of State in charge of implementing the ITAR, and against various government officials for exceeding their statutory authority and for violations of the First, Second, and the Fifth Amendment. We were later joined by Con Williamson as a plaintiff. Our Second Amendment claim was based on our argument that the right to possess firearms also includes the right to acquire them, and that the most basic means to acquire a firearm is to make it. We moved for a preliminary injunction. The court denied our preliminary injunction. We appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they affirmed the lower court's denial of our preliminary injunction in a 2-1 vote. Now, in her dissent, Judge Edith Jones wrote a very lengthy opinion in which she adopted pretty much every one of our First Amendment arguments for why the application of the ITAR to public speech involving firearms violates the First Amendment. We filed a writ of certiorari for the Supreme Court review, which was denied, and the case was remanded back to the Western District of Texas. It's at that time that the court ordered the parties to exchange written offers of settlement. And we received a very favorable offer from the Department of State. It basically gave us everything we were asking for. So Defense Distributed, Second Amendment Foundation, and Con Williamson accepted this settlement, which requires the Department of State to actually amend the ITAR to remove its controls on the technical data in question. It also requires the Department of State to issue a license to Defense Distributed while the amendment was pending, and a notification of a modification of the ITAR posted online to allow all U.S. persons to share, contribute, and otherwise use and benefit from that information. In short time, Everytown and Brady organizations filed motions to intervene to stop the settlement agreement. July 27th, 2018, we went down to Texas. The court denied the organization's motion to intervene. And that same day, the Department of State issued the license to Defense Distributed, posted the temporary modification, and Defense Distributed posted lawfully 10 CAD files. They were complete CAD files for AR-15, AR-10, Colt 1911, other guns and guns parts. But within a few days, various attorney generals across the nation, you know, blue states, filed motions to stop the publication. We had actions filed in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington State. We were able to obtain stays in New Jersey and Pennsylvania pending the outcome of the Washington State litigation. And in Washington State, it started off with 10 attorney generals. Now we're fighting 20 attorney generals, state attorney generals, if you include the District of Columbia. And they're arguing that the Department of State's actions under the settlement agreement violate what we call the Administrative Procedures Act, the APA. They have 2 points they raise here. One is that the Department of State didn't follow proper procedures under the Arms Export Control Act, which is the statutory authority for the ITAR, in that they say that there was a requirement that there be a 30-day advance notification to Congress before they issued this license to basically release this stuff on the Internet, which they said is tantamount to a release of controls. I've been working in ITAR for about a little over 15 years now, and I can tell you quite confidently they're wrong. The section they're talking about, Section 38F of the Arms Export Control Act, it doesn't apply to situations like we have. It doesn't apply to these license or modifications. Their second argument was that the decision by the Department of State was arbitrary and capricious. Again, they're wrong. The actual decision to transfer the firearms was not made by the Trump administration. It was made years ago as part of a larger export control reform initiative by the Obama administration. But plus, in a press release by the Department of State, they said the reason why they settled this matter was because the Department of Justice had told them that they were going to lose in court on First Amendment grounds. And that's pretty consistent with all the guidance the Department of Justice has been giving them since 1979. We presented all this information to the court, all the Department of Justice memoranda, even the report I discussed from 1997. The court still issued the injunction. The injunction is twofold. One, it says that the Department of State cannot issue the license and the temporary modification, but that was already issued and the information was published. So the court also held that we need to maintain the status quo, which really was the information was out there. But in the court's view, the status quo is that the parties need to treat the situation as if the license and the temporary modification were never issued. And so what that meant was we have basically a takedown order. Defense Distributed was required once again to take the information down from the Internet, and we now have a new type of censorship going on. The status of the case right now is that the parties have filed cross motions for summary judgment. We're awaiting a decision, and it's a hard fight. It's continuing, but it's worth fighting for. Thanks.
Well, good afternoon. My name is David Jensen. I'm an attorney in New York, and I have been handling Second Amendment cases since shortly after McDonald versus Chicago came down in 2010. Some of the organizations I've represented are the Second Amendment Foundation, the National Rifle Association, the Liberal Gun Club, as well as more state and local level organizations throughout Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and Illinois that I can even attempt to recall while standing here. In particular, at the present time, I am counsel on 2 petitions for writs of certiorari that are pending before the Supreme Court that raise the bearing arms issue. That's Gold versus Lipton out of the First Circuit concerning Massachusetts, and Cheeseman v. Pallello out of the New Jersey state court system concerning New Jersey. I'm also counsel in a case, Johnson versus Illinois State Police, that is currently pending oral argument before the Illinois Supreme Court. We won that case at the trial court level, a ruling of unconstitutionality, and the state attorney general appealed it directly to the state Supreme Court. So the topic here is winning firearms freedom one lawsuit at a time. And what I'd like to address is simply, where are we at now? And in particular, where are we at on this issue of the right to bear arms? And the answer is, ask me again in 11 days. The reason that's the answer is that, in all candor, from where we're at right now with the state of play in the federal circuit courts of appeals, we're not real likely to move the ball significantly down the field without some sort of decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that requires a reset of some of the decisions that have been handed down. In the 10 years or the 9.5 years since McDonald was decided, the Supreme Court has largely declined to get involved in right-to-bear-arms cases. But earlier this year, they granted certiorari in the case New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus City of New York, which, while not squarely a right-to-bear-arms case, concerns the validity of rules and regulations in the City of New York that effectively prohibit lawful or most lawful New York City gun owners from transporting their handguns outside the city, whether to a gun range, a second residence, whatever. So after they granted certiorari in that case, something kind of curious started to happen, which is that when cert petitions came in front of the court that challenged or that raised right to bear arms issues, they started sitting on them. Meaning, in the normal process at the Supreme Court, when the court is in session, they meet about once a week for what's called a conference session. And at that conference session, two of the most pertinent things they do, especially for this discussion, is they consider pending writs or petitions for writs of certiorari, pending cert petitions, and they also consider pending motions before the court. So what started happening is, in both Gold v. Lipton, the Massachusetts case I mentioned, as well as in Rogers v. Gruhl, which your friend and mine, Dan Schmutter, will probably talk about, when those cases went into conference, instead of issuing an order that certiorari is granted, certiorari is denied, they just did nothing. Meaning the case is sitting there pending, and presumably the angle is that they're going to make some sort of an order after they've decided the New York City case. So what else happened? Well, it turns out the City of New York really did not want to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the city adopted new rules and regulations, and the legislature changed state law in a manner that may very well result in that case being moot. And then the city came in and filed a motion and said, you should dismiss it. It's moot. And that motion, the court is scheduled to consider at its next scheduled conference date, which is October 1, 10 days from now. Now, what also started happening is, in the Cheeseman versus Palio case I mentioned a few minutes ago, we filed a cert petition on that last summer, and the court took the extraordinary step of requesting a response from the New Jersey officials on the other side of the case before it had gone into conference, and then scheduled it for submission also at that October 1 conference. So, as things stand now, on Wednesday, October 1, they are presumably going to go into chambers, they're going to decide this pending motion to dismiss as moot, and then they are going to take a look at all of these cert petitions. There is at least four I know of that have stacked up raising right-to-bear-arms issues, and they are going to make some sort of a decision about what, if anything, they are going to do with it. So, where are we at? Ask me on October 2. Keep your fingers crossed until then. Thank you.
You guys really aren't being paid by the word. Everybody's gone short so far. No. Anyway, Mr. Lee. Wait. If I got my, I didn't bring my book with me. I've got my math, my alphabet wrong. You're right, Don. Sorry. Okay, thank you. My apologies.
Good afternoon, my fellow patriots. My name is George Lee, and I am an attorney at Seiler Epstein LLP in San Francisco. Now, I flew in from San Francisco yesterday, so the good news is that apparently San Francisco hasn't enacted a terrorist no-fly list yet. So, think of my office as your outpost on the frontiers of liberty, surrounded by hostile and angry tribes. That's me. It is my great privilege and pleasure to be able to represent organizations like Second Amendment Foundation, Firearms Policy Coalition, CalGuns Foundation, and others in various state and federal litigation that we have going in California. And I would like to talk to you today about three cases that we and SAF have in California and give you the status of those. The first case I'd like to tell you about is a case called Weiss versus Becerra. And Weiss was the first filed challenge to California's large capacity magazine ban, which we filed in October 2017 after the California legislature enacted an oppressive package and relentless package of gun control measures, which we now not so fondly refer to as Gunmageddon. And the status of our case, Weiss, is currently stayed pending the outcome in a similar case brought by the California Rifle and Pistol Association called Duncan versus Becerra. And I'd like to take a moment just personally to point out the excellent work that attorneys Sean Brady and Anna Barvier did in that case to get a favorable ruling from the judge in enjoining the large capacity magazine ban. So our case, Weiss versus Becerra, is stayed pending the outcome of that case in the Ninth Circuit. But there are some differences that I'll just briefly mention to you. Our case, Weiss, does have additional claims that are not presented in Duncan, including a vagueness claim. Now, without getting too technical and into it, because I realize it's late in the afternoon, there are currently two different versions of the large capacity magazine ban that are chaptered, and look it up, that one version of which has exceptions. For example, if you have a firearm for which they never made a magazine that holds 10 rounds or fewer, that could be an exception. The other version, there are no such exceptions. Both are currently live active statutes. Which one's correct? I don't know. I guess we'll let the Ninth Circuit decide that someday. That's going to be irrespective of what happens in Duncan. And the other one is a challenge on equal protection grounds to the Hollywood exception, which allows an actor like Matt Damon to rant with anti-gun speeches during the day and take a large-capacity magazine home at night simply because he's a Hollywood actor. But if I may just divert for a minute about the legal aspect, I think the lesson of California's large-capacity magazine ban is that when they say, we'll grandfather these things in, don't believe them. It's a false promise. Because the fact of the matter is, in 2000, the California legislature banned the importation, sale, manufacture of new large capacity magazines. But they said, I guess to paraphrase Obama, if you like your magazines, you can keep your magazines. But 18 years later, not so much Obama, now it's Darth Vader. We have altered the deal. Pray that we don't alter it further. So the lesson of California's large capacity magazine ban is when they tell you that grandfathering will lessen the sting of these measures, don't believe in their false compromise. The second case I'd like to tell you about today is a case I'm excited about. We just filed it. It's a case called Miller versus Becerra. And this is a case that is currently in front of Judge Benitez, who gave the plaintiffs a favorable ruling in the magazine case. And this is a challenge to California's assault weapons statute once again. And this one is going to be based on features. Right now, it starts with magazines, but which are a feature, of course. But it's going to include all the standard AR-15 features, flash hider, collapsible stock, pistol grip. And I would like to thank the San Diego County gun owners for their ability to mobilize and organize very highly motivated people who can bring these types of claims. The goal in Miller is very simple. It is to restore the command of Heller, which states that governments may not ban by category firearms that are in common use for lawful purposes, such as self-defense, sport, or defense of country. And contrary to what they may say in the sheltered enclaves of San Francisco and Los Angeles, they don't have to drive very far, by the way. AR-15 rifles are indeed commonly owned by Americans of many stripes. And our own California Department of Justice estimated that from 2001 to 2016, there were an estimated 1.5 million legally owned firearms that they classify as assault weapons in California alone. So it is our hope that maybe someday, once again, a case called Miller will stand for the proposition that if it's good enough for militia service, it's good enough for an ordinary citizen. The third case I'd like to tell you about is a very interesting case. It's a case called Linton versus Becerra, and it's an interesting case based on undisputed, straightforward facts. Two gentlemen had nonviolent felony convictions from a long time ago in the states of Arizona and Washington, and those felony convictions have been set aside, vacated, and in fact, the judges of those states expressly ordered that these gentlemen have their Second Amendment rights restored to them. Now, notwithstanding these court orders from Arizona and Washington, the state of California simply refuses to recognize those court orders and considers these two gentlemen to be prohibited persons. So we've sued under a number of theories, including the Second Amendment, the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the Constitution, the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, and it might seem like small ball, but this is a case that matters. And why does it matter? Well, two things. First, this is actually a situation that occurs more often than you think. Ever since we filed the case, I actually get a number of calls, people saying they're in that same position. They have an out-of-state felony conviction that's been vacated or set aside, and California still denying them the right to own a firearm. But the second reason why this case matters is because what we're trying to do is roll back this mentality that rights are special privileges that the state can grant or deny at whim. The Attorney General in our case, in fact, confirmed this mentality when they said in their motion to dismiss our case, they said, quote, "The complaint's allegations center around two individual plaintiffs who each contend that they deserve this special treatment because an out-of-state court allegedly has set aside their felony convictions." They think that your Second Amendment rights are special treatment. So this is why we fight, and this is why we bring these lawsuits, and this is why we will restore the Second Amendment one lawsuit at a time. What's it like to bring Second Amendment cases in courts in California? Well, I like to think of our situation, without getting too grandiose about it, I like to think of our situation as like that battle off Samar during World War II, which took place in October 1944, where a small group of U.S. destroyers and escort carriers were surprised all of a sudden to find that they were the only force between our landing forces at Leyte Gulf and a Japanese fleet that came out of nowhere with battleships, cruisers, and destroyers, to suddenly find this force bearing down on them. And what did these American destroyer captains do when they were confronted by this overwhelming enemy force? The American destroyer captains laid down smoke and headed straight into the oncoming Japanese fleet. In the words of the late great writer Herman Wouk, who wrote of this battle through the voice of a fictional character, said, quote, "The vision of these three destroyers charging out of the smoke and the rain straight towards the main batteries of Kurita's battleships and cruisers can endure as a picture of the way Americans fight when they don't have superiority. Our school children should know about this incident, and our enemies should ponder it. In our fight and against these forces, let us endeavor always to lay down smoke and turn towards the enemy in a manner that our school children will remember and thank us for, and that our enemies will have to ponder. Thank you."
Now that my alphabet has been corrected, Mr. Kilmer.
You know, when there's a beautiful woman and there are seven helpers up here, I couldn't help but think of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And when I look at the talent that's up here on this table, I know who's dopey. Thank you, gentlemen, your wonderful colleagues. Well, even in California, we're starting to see some victories. Gun shows. 20 years ago, I filed Nordyke versus King to stop Alameda County from banning gun shows at the Alameda County Fairgrounds. And it took 13 years to finally win that case and have gun shows in Alameda County. Early this year, the Second Amendment Foundation, through my office, teamed up with the California Rifle and Pistol Association to stop the 22nd Agricultural District from imposing a moratorium on gun shows at the San Diego County Fairgrounds. While the government, quote-unquote, studied the issue and imposed a moratorium so that they could take a look at how dangerous gun shows were. Now, mind you, gun show gun sales account for 2% of gun sales in the state of California. And despite the attempt to characterize non-gun show events as attracting violence to the venue, it was actually other events that were causing problems for the police and the public safety people in San Diego County. Anyway, we managed to get a preliminary injunction to set aside the moratorium. In fact, next weekend, Crossroads of the West will host a gun show at that venue. In contrast to Nordyke, which took 13 years to resolve, we filed suit in January this year, and by June we had an injunction. And now we have defendants who want to go come to the negotiating table to try and resolve the case without further litigation. Hat tip to Mr. Michel's office and his team of lawyers, including Mr. Brady, Ms. Barbier, and Tiffany. And let me say something a little bit un-PC here. I, for one, am happy that female lawyers are starting to fill the ranks of Second Amendment advocates. They are oftentimes much more talented and reasonable than people like me. Of course, after beating up on the 22nd Agricultural District, the California Legislature and Governor Newsom now want to try and pass a state law completely banning gun shows on county properties. So look for this case to go into extra innings, folks. Gun confiscations. I'm currently litigating a case in the Ninth Circuit, Rodriguez versus City of San Jose. We just had to file a petition for en banc review earlier this month after the Ninth Circuit made up, out of whole cloth, an exception to the Fourth Amendment for seizing weapons from the spouse of somebody who is prohibited and refusing to return firearms after she had transferred the weapons to herself, had got the California Department of Justice to release the firearms to her, had proven that she had a state-approved gun show or gun safe, and the city of San Jose still refuses to return the guns. That case also will be going into extra innings. California roster, you've heard some other very fine advocates up here talking about Pena versus Hogan. That's a case that I'm privileged to work with Mr. Gura on. It is currently pending with the United States Supreme Court on a petition for certiorari with that court. It is a challenge to California's handgun roster. You've already heard enough about that. But it is an essential principle that we cannot let the government win these the gun prohibition fight through the death from a thousand cuts battle. And that's essentially what they are doing. If they can keep advancing inch by inch, cut by cut, we'll end up one day in California with single-shot 22s. One case that we are currently litigating and we are just getting ready to enter the discovery phase is a case called Roe versus United States. Now, the plaintiffs in this case are all named by pseudonyms because we're dealing here with the intersection of gun rights and mental health issues. In California, we have two procedures for what are called mental health holds. There's a 5150, which is an unadjudicated mental health hold, where if you have a mental health episode and we're not really sure what your diagnosis is, you can be held for 3 days without judicial intervention at all to see whether or not you are a danger to yourself or others. That results in California in the loss of your gun rights for 5 years unless you go back to court to get your rights restored. And oftentimes, and I do a lot of this work in my practice, oftentimes the rights are restored. Oftentimes, you shouldn't lose your gun rights because you've had a bad day. But California also has a process called 5250, which is an adjudicated hold. Once you've been there is a judge who has said, we're going to hold you for longer than 3 days, oftentimes up to 14 days, then federal consequences kick in. And the federal consequences for an adjudicated mental health hold are for life. Now, this issue was recently litigated in the Sixth Circuit, and in a case called Tyler versus Hillsdale, and it actually went up to en banc, never got to the U.S. Supreme Court. The government lost that case, where the en banc panel of the Sixth Circuit returned a decision that said, you must have some form of review to restore rights in place. And since the federal government does not have one, the case was sent back to the district court for further litigation. Roe versus United States will be the Ninth Circuit version of that case, so that we can get the issue resolved once and for all. On a personal note, I'll be moving my base of operations to the state of Idaho. Hang on. Not because the gun situation in California is that bad. The gun situation in California is tolerable. We are winning there, one suit at a time. But it's let's call it pre-retirement planning for me. In any case, of course, California is sinning in other areas other than our gun rights. California is addicted to high taxes, business regulation, poor land management, poor resource management, homeless encampments, and now we see medieval diseases starting to spring up in our urban centers like the plague, typhus, and cholera. So let's remember that in my closing remarks, or never forget that the Second Amendment is just one of the bricks in the foundation of a civil society. We must strive to preserve and protect all the rights that were deeded to us by our ancestors. Otherwise, we squander their sacrifice and their wisdom. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from New Jersey, and finally, we'll hear from Illinois.
One of the lights in my room is not working, so I was wondering how many gun owners it takes to screw in a light bulb. Turns out the answer is 4. 1 to screw in the light bulb, and 3 to argue with each other as to whether the light should have been a shore fire or a stream light. Go figure. My name is Dan Schmutter. I'm an attorney in New Jersey and New York, and I've represented a number of Second Amendment organizations, including Second Amendment Foundation, Firearms Policy Coalition, Cal Guns, the National Rifle Association, the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, and an organization called Knife Rights that I think many of you are familiar with. Now, as I said, I handle cases in New York and New Jersey. I'd like to start with New York. I want to give an update on the New York City Gravity Knife lawsuit that has been sponsored by Knife Rights. I know a lot of you who've come to this conference year after year have heard me talk about that case. It's been going on for many, many years. This was our lawsuit against New York City to stop them from arresting ordinary folks carrying ordinary pocket knives, alleging that these knives were gravity knives, arrests to the tune of tens of thousands of people. Now, you may have heard that we achieved a wonderful legislative victory when New York Governor Andrew Cuomo finally repealed the horrific law that resulted in all of these arrests and folks being jailed. But you may not have heard how it came about. Now, the key to this story is coalition building and what we might call big tent activism. Now, the effort involved 8 years of litigation and years of legislative efforts. Spearheading this all were, of course, Knife Rights Chairman Doug Ritter and Director of Legislative Affairs for Knife Rights Todd Raffner. But what we managed to do was loop in a whole host of disparate participants in the legislative and the litigation effort to achieve what Todd has described as, quote, probably the only pro-Second Amendment law ever to be passed in New York. We had Democrats and Republicans. We had the New York Legal Aid Society, NAACP, ACLU, the Cato Institute, the NRA, unions, the New York Times, and all sorts of other people, all involved in that effort, either in the legislative side, the litigation side, and sometimes both. And, you know, to show how such, you know, this kind of cooperation can work, for 3 years, the New York legislature overwhelmingly passed a repeal of the gravity knife law, and twice the governor vetoed it. But you need to persist. And this year, the bill was passed again, overwhelmingly by the legislature. In fact, I believe it was unanimous. And it hit the governor's desk just as the United States Supreme Court was considering our petition for writ of certiorari in the long-running litigation, Copeland versus Vance. And there was also another conveniently timed lawsuit called Cracco v. Vance. And I'm pleased to say that the bill's sponsor credited our 8 years of relentless litigation as being one of the material factors in getting the governor to finally sign that bill repealing the gravity knife prohibition. So we're very pleased with that, and you know, it really does show that when you have a lot of different people cooperating, and when you think about this struggle and this effort as the type of thing that can involve all sorts of different people from different organizations, different groups, and different walks of life, you can really achieve extraordinary things, especially in a place like New York. I want to talk about another case. A number of people have already talked about the case before the United States Supreme Court, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. Dave Coppola spoke at length about it. I know Dave Jensen spoke about it as well. You've heard that several of us have cert petitions that are now sitting at the court awaiting to see what the court's going to do with the New York City case. Don has the Pena case, Dave Jensen has the Gould case, and I want to talk a little bit about one of the cases that I have, which is Rogers versus Grewal. Now, this is a challenge to New Jersey's highly restrictive carry law. As you may know, there are still a few jurisdictions where carry is very, very highly restricted. New Jersey is one of them, of course, New York, California, Maryland, Hawaii. And so this is a challenge. You may remember from years ago the Drake decision from the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, where Second Amendment Foundation challenged the New Jersey law back then, and unfortunately the result went against us. This time, we decided to bring the case again in light of the very, very positive decision in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in the Wren and Grace cases. And so now we have a petition sitting at the Supreme Court again awaiting the results in the New York City case. And, you know, we're all We're all hoping for a very good result. We'll see what happens. We'd like to see not just a positive result, but a result that will guide the lower courts who have really been abusing the decisions in Heller and McDonald. We've been seeing for 10 years, we've been seeing the courts coming out with all sorts of absurd results based upon a twisting and turning of those decisions. And so hopefully we'll see something in the New York City case that will set the lower courts in the right direction. And hopefully we'll see some guidance and some further proceedings in Gould and Rogers and in Pena and some of the other cases. I know the Second Amendment Foundation also has a case called Mance, which is also sitting at the Supreme Court waiting to see what happens. So that's a case where, I think as folks have mentioned, argument in the New York City case is December 2nd, and presumably we'll see what they do with that. I want to talk about another case. This is, everybody knows how bad New Jersey is. Some people know a little bit better how bad New Jersey is, but everybody understands that it's a terrible place when it comes to gun rights. Well, what not a lot of people know is that we now have a very, very anti-gun attorney general, and what he's trying to do is he's trying to export his very, very anti-Second Amendment views and exert power outside of New Jersey. And what they've done is they've developed a new legal theory under New Jersey's consumer fraud law. New Jersey's consumer fraud law is a statute that is very widely and very broadly construed by the courts. It gives the Attorney General very substantial power to proceed against sellers of goods on the basis of on the theory of fraud. And so what the Attorney General now contends is that it is a violation of the consumer fraud statute, that it is a commission of consumer fraud to sell a product to New Jersey buyers without disclosing the law that governs the product's use. Now think about that. It is fraud, according to the Attorney General, to sell a product unless you give legal advice as to how you could violate New Jersey law with that product. Now that's an enormous power grab, and it really represents a massive expansion of executive authority in New Jersey. Now, the case that I'm handling involving this new theory of law, and we're concerned about it because we think that if the Attorney General in this sort of test run is successful, he'll continue to export this theory as to other companies trying to sell goods to New Jersey buyers. So in this case is called Graywall versus James Trombley and U.S. Patriot Army. So the Attorney General sued a website operator named James Trombley, and he operates a website called U.S. Patriot Armory, and they sell lots of things, but one of the things they sell are 80% receivers. And the allegation is that now 80% receivers are not per se illegal in New Jersey. They passed a law last year which said it's illegal to buy them with the intent to finish them into an unserialized firearm without a manufacturer's license. What the Attorney General is saying is that it's fraud to sell those to New Jersey without telling people that it's illegal to finish them, to have the intent to finish them into an unserialized firearm without without a manufacturer's license. Now, if you can tell someone, if you can sue someone for fraud because they didn't advise you on the law as to how you can misuse the product and get into trouble, you can really sue anybody. You can sue Macy's for selling kitchen knives without telling them that it's illegal to carry a kitchen knife in your pocket as a weapon, which it is in New Jersey, by the way. You can sue a car dealer for selling a car and not informing them that it's illegal to exceed the speed limit. So we're pushing back on this lawsuit. We're hoping to defeat this new legal theory in its infancy to prevent it from spreading around the country. Thank you.
Hot dog, I got 9 extra minutes. All right, you guys have been listening to lawyers for an hour, and appreciate how you guys are all holding up so far. I'm going to ask you to hold on just a little bit longer. I'm pretty sure the next panel is non-lawyers. Is that right? So you have that to look forward to. My name is David Siegel. I am a practitioner in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, and I represent the Second Amendment Foundation on a number of matters, and I am also counsel for the Illinois State Rifle Association. Shout out to the good guys over there. And Illinois Carry is also out that way, and I represent them. And quite frankly, without those groups, there's no way that I could be doing what I'm doing. So thank you all these groups for their help, and especially for SAF for giving this platform to talk to you today. There's a number of things going on in Illinois and really across the United States that I wanted to talk to you about today. Try to give you the abbreviated versions, though. There are three cases, Miller versus Walker, Johnson versus Lyon, Attaway versus Corsi. Those cases are in Illinois and Michigan and Missouri, respectively. They all have they all concern the issue of Second Amendment rights for foster parents. The states have rules that if you are a foster parent in that state, you must abide by certain regulations, which generally include disarming yourself. They all put in force, what the governments like to call safe storage requirements, where you have to have your firearm and your ammunition in separate locations and separate safes, and that does you pretty much no good if someone happens to break in at 2 a.m. Also, if you are licensed to carry, you're not allowed to carry on your person in the home, and if you happen to have a carry permit outside the home, well, too bad, you're not allowed to do that either. The Miller case in Illinois also challenges similar restrictions for home daycare providers. Now, let's be very clear about all of these cases. These cases are not about acting stupid and leaving guns in the toy box or anything like that. It is about carrying them, storing them responsibly, but also storing them, being able to carry or store them in such a fashion that if you actually need them, you'd be able to use them. So, for example, in those cases, the plaintiffs are not challenging, say, when you're not using the firearm, lock it up in a safe, but they want to be able to lock it up loaded, so that at 2 a.m., if they need to open the safe, they have it ready for them. The Illinois case is in the discovery period, so is the Michigan case. The Missouri case is kind of in a forced settlement type of stage. The court wanted to see if it could be worked out, and so we're trying to, and we'll see what happens with that. Missouri, of course, has a constitutional carry state, and they recently added to their constitution a strict scrutiny standard that for Second Amendment rights. And we're hoping that that action will spur the government to come to see reason on this case. So that's what's going on there. A number of people have talked about housing authority cases. We filed, and by we, I guess, SAF, ISRA, what we filed as Doe versus East St. Louis Housing Authority. This was a case where we had to file it under a pseudonym because the housing authority resident had a violent ex-paramour recently out of prison who threatened to kill her if he ever found her. In the meantime, she's living in a housing authority where if she has a firearm in her home for self-defense, she can get kicked out. At the same time, she had been attacked and sexually assaulted in her own house, and the only thing that saved her was her kid getting the gun out of the safe, so which scared the guy off. The housing authority saw reason on that one. They were able to agree to an injunction, and that case has been won. And this is real nice. It's nice to have, you know, a pat on the back and attaboy, but You when you do this job, when you have a client crying in happiness on the other side of the phone, when you tell her that the the authority, the government, whatever, whatever's got the boot on her neck is no longer going to be able to do so. That's why I do this. There's a couple cases. One's in, you also heard a reference to it earlier. One is called Cole versus Norridge, Illinois. One is called Second Amendment Arms versus City of Chicago. Both of them are challenges to gun store bans. Both of them were pending for a very long time, and it took all that time to basically get the village, get the city to change their restrictions, change their regulations. They kept doing it incrementally, as government often does. They would say, okay, well, we're not going to ban it anymore, but you can only have it here. Okay, well, you can't just have it here. You can have it in other places, but you got to do this. And so on and so forth. So the Norridge case was recently resolved after the village finally loosened its restrictions enough. In the City of Chicago case, they had to repeal their gun store ban, and now that case is still in its pending stages on damages. The Wilson case, Wilson versus Cook County, is the assault weapon case. There is a cert petition. We lost at the Seventh Circuit. There's a cert petition due at towards the end of November. We were trying to weave the case around the 2015 Friedman case in the Seventh Circuit, which basically upheld a ban on assault weapons. We said this one is different. Cook County as a whole is different from Highland Park, Illinois. You have to allow us to take that into the consideration. The Seventh Circuit said, no, we don't. We really don't see a difference. And they dismissed our complaint and upheld the dismissal of our complaint. And now we are, like I said, heading for a cert petition on that. Case of Culp versus Madigan, now Culp versus Raoul. The state has a virtual ban on almost every non-Illinois resident from applying for a concealed carry license. The courts, unfortunately, have upheld that regulation, that restriction. They've said, well, we don't know if we can trust the people, and we have no way of knowing. And we've said, well, you don't know if you can trust Illinois residents either, and yet you give concealed carry licenses to those people that go through the training and are qualified. You should do the same for other people in other states as well. The cert petition will be coming in a couple weeks for that one. Also on the vein of assault weapons is the Easterday versus Village of Deerfield case. This is a case where village after the state changed its gun laws in 2013, changed its licensing laws and whatnot, and said, we're taking over. We are preempting this field of assault weapons. If you want to get in and do something different, you have right now to do it. Deerfield said, okay, we'll have a bunch of restrictions, storage requirements and whatnot. 5 years later, they say, that's not good enough. We're going to ban them. We sued them saying, well, state preemption controls that. The court has agreed with us, and they entered a permanent injunction. But the court recently made a ruling that's going to allow Deerfield to appeal that to the Illinois Appellate Court, so we'll be seeing how that goes. I'm actually surprised I haven't gotten that notice of appeal yet, but I'm sure it's coming. Lastly is a couple cases regarding Illinois is one of three states that requires you to have a firearm license just to possess a firearm. Massachusetts, I think, is the second, and New York requires one for handguns. If you just want to possess one in your home, a woman in downstate Illinois, her ex-husband or her some status of husband called the police on her, said she's firing a gun in the house. Cops showed up, and no, she wasn't. But the cops did find the 22, the rifle that she had, by the bolt action by her bed for protection, and charged her with not having a firearm license, a firearm owner ID card, a FOID card. The judge struck the license requirement down as unconstitutional for requiring someone just who's law-abiding to just have a long gun by their bed or for in their home for self-defense. Judge said it's unconstitutional to require you to have a license. The state appealed that to the Illinois Supreme Court. Those arguments were 10 days ago, and we'll see how that turns out. I would hope that the argument that this is something that in the day of the framers people were required to do, and in fact in one instance the state even paid for a firearm if you didn't have one to have one for protection. So hopefully the court will see. And I made the point, to be clear, it's not about handguns, it's not about buying guns, selling guns, anything like that. But if you want, like in colonial days, a long gun for protection, you should be able to have it. In closing, in addition to this, the state likes to take gun rights away and they don't like to give them back. People appeal and they say, I should have my rights back. They don't get them. And sometimes they force us to go to court. Sometimes the denials are ridiculous. We'll be filing suits very soon to overturn what is really just a broken system of restoring FOID rights, returning concealed carry rights. We're doing this on an individual basis. We're going to be having a vehicle very soon to try and make this a bigger issue to help all the people of Illinois. And I guess I'll update you all that next year. So thank you very much.
Okay, I have two surprises. One, we have lost one of our screens, so we're going to take a five-minute break. Don't anybody move. Okay? Nobody move. And the second surprise is for the attorneys up here. This is not being filmed, so you all are safe. All right? The table mics are live. Okay. They're live. I have three questions here, and I can't decide which one to ask you each. So I think I will ask the three different questions and just go down. You're going to get whatever question you get. All right? Don Kilmer,
all right.
What do you think is the most important Second Amendment case that needs to be brought?
Okay, that needs to be brought. Well, if it needs to be brought, we should have brought it already, I guess.
Okay.
No, I think the most pressing issue that we're dealing with today is going to be dealing with these so-called red flag laws, because we're going to be dealing with California's had these for going on 15 years now. The Rodriguez versus San Jose case, although it was a mental health case, is very much a red flag case. Because this is an instance where the police seized a personal firearm from a wife who she'd done nothing wrong. This gun was registered to her. The police knew it was registered to her. She objected to the gun being taken. They took it anyway. So this idea that the government can come in and disarm not just you if you're having a mental health crisis or you've committed a crime, but also disarm your family members, this is going to be a very dangerous area to tread on. And so we're going to need to gear up for dealing with these red flag laws.
Okay. We're going to have to limit to about 60 seconds, which means you'll take about 75. Matthew, besides Heller, what is the most important 2A case to date, either pro-2A or anti-2A?
As a new kid on the block, I'm going to pass on that one.
Okay.
It's tough.
All right. Then why did you go into 2A law?
Hmm?
Why did you go into 2A law?
Why did I go into 2A law?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. 2A law to me is kind of a part and parcel of what I do on the trade law. I work day to day with a government agency, the Department of State, which is very, very... It has plenary foreign affairs powers, but very much it does not care about domestic rights. And the area that is impacted on the most is the Second Amendment.
Okay. Thank you. No. No, I only get to, I'm queen for the day, so I only get to ask the questions. Okay, Mr. Lee, besides Heller, what is the most important two-way case to date, pro or anti?
I think the city of Highland Park is a significant, which is a Seventh Circuit case that did not go our way, is a significant case because it allows, among other things, weapons to be banned categorically in complete violation of the commandment of Heller, because certain weapons make people feel uncomfortable, because they engender scary feelings, which is part of the ruling. It wasn't the complete ruling, but part of the ruling. So I would say that that loss, although it didn't go our way, and the fact that it seems to ignore Heller pretty blatantly, is a case that needs to be revisited at some point.
Okay. Mr. Dillon, what do you think is the most important Second Amendment case that needs to be brought besides red flag laws, which we don't have a case for yet?
Well, the red flag laws was going to be my answer. Like Don, I also have fought against these 5150 mental health holds in California. I think they truly are some of the most dangerous laws and restrictions that are being implemented against law-abiding citizens. Outside of that, I'm a big fan of bringing everyone we can, to be honest. If we can think it up, let's do it.
Okay. Sounds good to me. David. Oh, sorry. The my farthest right, David. How did you get into 2A law?
Well, unfortunately, I'll try to make this a 60-second answer. I had just opened my practice. I got a call from my friend Alan Gura, who said that the Supreme Court had just granted certiorari, agreed to hear the Heller case. He said he knew some people that if they actually win that case, they might win, that wanted to go after Chicago. Did I want to be in? And he said to me, don't answer right away. He said, could be controversial, people picketing outside your door, that kind of thing. Think about whether it's something you really want to be a part of. And in that time, like right before he asked me, there were about two or three stories in the previous month in the Chicago papers. Women who, were found dead with 911 on the phone in one hand and a useless restraining order in the other. And I called Alan back and I said, if I can do something to help those people or the next people, how do I say no to that? So I guess the rest is literally history.
Okay. The other David. I have three Allens in my life, so I call them Alan, the other Alan, and the other Alan. So you'll just be the other David. What do you think is the most important 2A case that needs to be brought?
Well, I'll assume it's aside from red flag laws, and I would agree that the red flag law issue is going to be significant, particularly exactly how those laws are set up, where the burdens are, and what the rights of review are. Aside from that, I think I would have to say the standards that govern the denial or revocation of firearms licenses, and that has a close relationship to the ability to obtain relief from firearms disabilities, which has a close relationship to what is a valid firearms disability, and are there some things like, say, misdemeanor convictions that might be valid disabilities for some period of time, but not for the rest of your life.